am a sentimental minimalist, which is a tough thing to pull off, but I do try. For a while, I was writing obituaries for things that carried special memories, even though they had obviously overstayed their welcome in my cabinets and drawers. Shirts I would never wear again because they were ripped or stained, but that I'd worn on happy occasions. Writing little tributes helped me let go of the stuff itself. The objects that have stayed with me, despite all this effort to purge, mean a lot to me, even though they may not look like much to anyone else. I'm not alone. The authors of a book that came out this year asked 150 people to tell them about the one object they will always cherish because of the meaning it carries. It's a beautiful testament to the almost magical power objects can hold. I'm Gina Kaufman. Let's welcome Bill Shapiro to KCUR's Central Standard. He's one of the authors of What We Keep. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I am so glad to be here.
I'm so glad, too. Your book starts with a locket. Can you tell that story?
I can. So my co-author and I were driving around sort of junk shopping on this one particular day, and we stopped at this you know, flea market junk sale, and she reached into this bin and pulled out this locket, and it was old and fragile and beautiful. And on the inside there was this inscription that said, "My love forever." And there was a date. It said 1911. And I went and I asked the woman running the sale, you know, what she knew about the locket, you know, who it belonged to, where it came from. And she didn't know a thing. And my co-author Naomi and I started to ask ourselves, how is it possible for an object that was once so intimate and so meaningful for these two people to wind up at the end of a driveway, you know, for sale to strangers?
Yeah.
Yeah. For complete strangers. And so as we started to think about how that happened and the sort of life cycle of this object, you know, that's one of the many factors that led to the creation of this book.
I am guessing, though, that this turned into a conversation that involved thinking about your own objects and talking about that with people you knew.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, first, you know, we started thinking about and talking about what we had kept, but then pretty quickly we started to ask our friends and our friends of friends, and then the most, you know, sort of creative and unpredictable people that we knew, what they held on to. And the stories that came from them really confirmed our sort of thesis that these objects tell unbelievable stories, stories that you can never guess at, and frankly, stories that should be preserved.
Can you give just a couple of examples of the things people told you about for the book, things that made it into this book? It's a large book. It's 150 stories. But what really jumps out to you as poignant or interesting just off the top of your head?
Oh, my God. Well, we interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people to get down to this 150.
Wow.
So there was a lot of conversations over 3 years, and we spoke to people all over the country, and people in the highest economic realms and the lowest, and blue states and red states, and you know, famous people and people who wanted to be anonymous. But to answer your question, you know, one of my favorite stories is actually the bottle opener that was referenced at the very top of your sort of introduction. It's a very plain Jane bottle opener, you know, $1.99. You could find it anywhere. But the guy who owns it, who happens to live in Idaho, had never told this story to anybody else ever before. It's a very meaningful bottle opener to him because it was given to him by his grandmother, who lived in San Francisco in the 60s and 70s. And she was sort of a buttoned-up CPA, hair pulled back and straight-laced. But that was a cover. She was actually the biggest marijuana importer in the country. And for him, the bottle opener represents why she did what she did. And that was not necessarily to make a lot of money, but to make people feel better. There was a lot of sick people that came to her for help and for a medicine of sorts. And that changed his life. And he ended up working in a cardiac cardiac care for a decade, and then in nonprofits.
Why did the bottle opener represent that?
It was something that she gave him. She didn't have a lot of objects. She had almost nothing. But that's the thing. It could have been a fork, you know? It could have been perhaps a bottle cap. But it was just something that she gave him, and he imbued all of that backstory into this bottle opener. And that's what was so interesting about this book, is that you never could guess at the story that the object held.
The title of this book includes the word magic. 150 people share the object that brings them joy, magic, and meaning. The other two words feel pretty straightforward to me. What do you mean by magic?
I mean time travel, in that, not literally, but holding an object, having something tactile in your hand, can transport you back to the time when you got that thing, or when that thing became meaningful to you, and you can almost remember the scenes, the sights, the smells. It can also kind of rekindle that magical, deep connection that you had with perhaps the person who gave it to you. So it's not just remembering somebody, but it's that deep sense of
like connection. Their hand touched that thing, or that there's
That's exactly right. And to know that, like, okay, your mother and your mother's mother held this book, read from this book, listened to the melody, opened that locket, that locket, you know, perhaps was the thing that brought your great-grandparents together. I mean, that is magic.
Bill, the timing of this book is interesting to me for a couple of reasons. One is our memories and our interactions are becoming so much more digital than physical.
Well, so that's exactly right. One of the things we noticed, and this was even before the locket moment that I talked about a moment ago, our relationship to objects is actually changing. And in large part, that's thanks to the cloud, because now we can own tons and tons of stuff, you know, records, books, photos, and never touch any of it. It's also thanks to the sharing economy, which makes it easier for us to borrow than to own. So those are, you know, two of a few other reasons why, you know, Naomi and I really felt that as things do move to digital, there's more and more of a need to really think about what these physical three-dimensional objects bring to our lives.
The other thing about this moment is the Marie Kondo phenomenon, which I know is not technically in opposition to anything you're saying, because I think she would encourage people to keep the thing they feel this way about. But there's this general sense in the air these days. It's a very anti-stuff.
Right. There is something else going on. So it's the Marie Kondo moment, and she says kind of, get rid of those things that don't spark joy when you touch them. And that sparking of joy, you know, may be another word for the magic that you and I were talking about a minute ago. But I think we're at a place in our culture where we're starting to move from being a culture of object acquisition to a culture of object prioritization. So I don't know if you're familiar with the tiny house movement.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So same thing. People are, you know, giving up their 2,000 square foot homes and moving into a house that's, you know, 148 square feet. There's also something called Swedish death cleaning. Have you heard of that?
No, this is new to me.
Okay, well, it's actually a thing, and not just in Sweden. It's a method that is sort of being urged for people to go through their stuff long years and years before they're going to pass away, to sort of a meditation of why we've kept what we've kept, and that nothing lasts forever, and also to clear out stuff so that your kids don't have to deal with that stuff once you die. But all those things taken together do sort of lead me to believe that we're at a moment when the few objects that really mean something to us are worth thinking about.
Yeah, because also some of these things are so mundane that you might think to get rid of them, and then the thought process that someone isn't going to have to deal with them later, that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is they're not going to get to make that choice for themselves. I think about that the things that I have, you know, my dad's no longer with me. The things that I have that bring him to me are they are very mundane things, like his handwriting on just a dumb little note on a post-it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that note could just say, you know, take the bread out of the oven at 4 o'clock.
It actually says from the desk of God, but that captures so a personality.
So much better. But yeah, so in those words and in that object, you know, that your father touched that thing. And that's, you know, that's beautiful and that's meaningful.
So what's your object?
My object is, it is a handwritten signed as well, actually. It's two pieces of notebook paper that were hastily taped together with, you know, terrible handwriting on it. And it was a hitchhiking sign that I made with my friend Fred when I was in college hitchhiking out of East Germany. And it says in German, which is a language I do not speak, Irgendwo. And that means anywhere. And I keep it because that was a time of my life when I could just go anywhere at any time. And it didn't matter. It was about the journey, you know, and that was way before my life had narrowed a little bit and I have to think about life insurance and car insurance and mortgage payments. And I keep it because I want to get back to that feeling in my life where I could just go.
And you can access that a little bit on Contact?
Yeah, and it, you know, it's kind of a North Star for me a little bit, so that I look at that and I'm like, oh yeah, that's where I'm heading. That's where I want to be heading.
Let's talk to Gavin. Gavin's calling from Overland Park. Hi, Gavin.
Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. I wanted to tell you about a painting I own. It's a very good friend of mine. I'm well into my 50s, and ever since the seventh grade, I've been very good friends with Brian. And Brian's mother bought in the early 1970s a painting from an artist who's sort of famous, at least here in Kansas. His name is Robert Sudlow. And she was a fan of his work from early on. And in the 70s, she went to his studio in Lawrence and said she wanted to buy a painting. And he was working at the time. He wasn't unkind or unpleasant, but he just sort of gestured and said, the finished ones are over there. Pick one you like and tell me what you think it's worth. And so she found one. She purchased it, and it hung in their house literally ever since I've known them. And that's about 40-plus years at this point. And she always had it hanging. I always loved it. And Brian, as well as his parents, were very important to me growing up. They did a lot of good for me. And Brian's parents died a couple of years ago, one 3 years ago and the other one 2 years ago. And when it was time to clear out her house, he wanted me to have the painting. And he made me an incredibly generous offer about the pricing on it. I still couldn't afford it, but he wanted me to have it so much that he undid and sweetened the deal and made it more affordable, talked it over with my wife, and it now hangs happily over my mantle, and I look at it literally every day, and every day, if I could borrow from Marie Kondo, it brings me joy.
It's interesting to me that it's not the artist who the painting reminds you of, it's Brian and his family. It's your friends.
That's exactly right. I mean, I love the artist. I look for his work. He was a professor of art at KU as well, and they have a huge collection. And I find myself online kind of browsing his paintings periodically. But, yeah, I would not have bought a Sudlow. I couldn't have afforded one just, you know, on its own, but I wouldn't have bought one necessarily just because it was his, even though I do love what he paints. I bought it because of Brian and his family, and I'm almost tearing up thinking about how much love that painting represents to me.
How old were you when you started hanging out in Brian's house?
About 12 years old.
Do you remember the feeling of being about that age and being in that house when you see that painting? Because I think of things when I was a kid, there are these objects that the textures of the world, I don't know, maybe it's something that you're still filing away new information in a particular way, but I really feel like kids are very attuned to texture and pattern and the way light is hitting things and the way that these snapshots kind of live in our visceral memories.
Oh, yes, I do remember it. I remember it well. And the thing is, Brian's parents were significantly better off than my family was at the time. And I was always very, very welcome there. And I remember thinking that their house was absolutely, you know, a palace. Looking back, it wasn't. And actually, right before Brian sold his house, or their house, we all went back for one last, me, Brian, and two other very close friends from high school, went back over there and had one last night where we watched movies from our high school days, grilled some steaks, and just hung out. And in keeping with the veracity of our youth, no women anywhere to be found, and just enjoyed the whole evening, the whole presence. And yes, I remember everything about Brian's house that I possibly could, and the impressions that it made on me even at that young age.
Gavin, thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for doing this. This is a great segment.
Bill, what do you hear in Gavin's comments that maybe connects to what you heard when you asked hundreds of people this question about the one object they treasure?
Well, that's exactly right. And the word you used was, you know, connects. And that's really it. You know, these objects are often not about the thing, as I mentioned, but clearly there was a connection to this other home that he spent time in and with these other parents who he had a relationship. And who knows what they gave him or what they represented to him, but there was certainly a warmth around that house that had some deeper meaning. And you know, if I was interviewing him for the book, we'd go deeper into that. But as he was talking, it actually reminded me so much of a story that's in the book from a man named Ray Pietro, who lives in Cleveland and actually started the first indoor mountain bike park.
Good for him.
Exactly. His grandmother used to have this folding tin cup that his grandfather brought back from the war. And when he was in church out in the sticks in Ohio, and he would get fidgety as a kid, his grandmother would send him to the basement of the church to get a glass of water, and she'd hand him this cup, and he would, you know, go through the pew and be like, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, and go down and open this cup that was collapsible and yet held water. And he talks about the texture of it, to your point, the tactile nature of it, and the taste of the cup when the rim hits your lips. And I think that is something that you capture in a part of your brain when you are a kid. And it sort of speaks to a larger connection.
I love the quotes that accompany the photos in this book about the things people keep. One of a hat, someone says, "It's this absolute tangible reminder that my life was once that weird."
Yes, that actually comes from Joss Whedon, who is the person who created Buffy the Vampire Slayer and wrote one of the Toy Stories and so many other things, Avengers, I think. And he went to boarding school in England, he's an American, for a year, and then ended up staying there. And it was this very Harry Potter-esque boarding school. And it was all men, and they wore suits, and he had this, they had to wear this sort of straw boater hat. And he keeps that from the time he was 17 or 18, because for that very reason, it reminds him of this time when his life was just, when he was like in a time capsule in a place that shouldn't exist in the modern era.
And also, there are these periods of, for a lot of us, I think, that are almost like a dream because they don't really have much to do with life before or after. And I feel like physical objects from those kinds of experiences are like, yeah, that really happened.
Yeah, it's real. It's real. You weren't dreaming.
I have proof.
Exactly.
There's another celebrity one that really touched me. It's a shell. And this is from Cheryl Strayed of Wild and the Tiny Beautiful Things. And
right.
Dear Sugar.
She
writes, "The shame about being poor goes all the way back, and having a glorious shell was the opposite of that."
So the story behind that show is amazing and not uncomplicated for her, but she had that shell in her house. It was her mother's. It was one of those sort of big Murex shell, kind of exotic, but it had been turned into a pincushion. And for show and tell, they were asked to bring something into class. Her mother was poor, a single mom, three kids, and according to Cheryl, as a child, they had nothing that was cool except for this shell. But she wanted it to be a shell and not a pincushion because she wanted to tell everybody that she had found it on an exotic beach. Because even as a kid, 6 years old, she sort of fancied herself as the kind of person who was an adventurer, who would be lucky, who would go to an exotic place. And the fact that she did, that she has become this traveler and this writer and this adventurer, every time she looks at the shell now, it brings her back to that, and for her really represents her core and the dreams she had and the dreams that were fulfilled for her.
It does seem significant, though. I mean, that is a memory with a lot of emotional weight, and it's all over the emotional spectrum. These are not all happy memories that people are keeping in touch with through objects.
Well, that is exactly right. In fact, a lot of them, some of these objects take us back to, and the reason that they are saved is because they take us back to a time when we got over something difficult or complicated. It could be a moment where we had a choice of sort of two roads to go, but often it's this moment of, how did I get over this? You know, there's a story in the book from a high school student who, when she was about, I think, 8 years old or 8 and a half, her mom gave her a little metal puzzle. And she played with the puzzle. It's one of those, like, you know, where it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and you have to arrange all the little numbers and put them in order. And she played with the puzzle, and she loved the puzzle. And then when her mother passed away unexpectedly, she held on to the puzzle. And that puzzle brings back so many feelings of her mom and what her mom physically gave her as well as emotionally.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. We've been revisiting a conversation from back in May with Bill Shapiro. It's about a book he co-wrote with his partner, Naomi Wax. The book is What We Keep. 150 people share the one object that brings them joy, magic, and meaning. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and our guest is Bill Shapiro. He's a former editor of Life magazine, and he and his partner co-authored a book documenting the one treasured thing that people have in their possession. 150 different people have their stories in this book. That's out of hundreds they interviewed, and it's all about the one thing they will always keep that holds almost magical power for them. Hi again, Bill.
Hi.
We were just going through a couple of objects that stood out to me in the book, and I'm using kind of the quotes that accompany the photographs to take you into them. One of my favorites is, "I never felt closer to my dad than when we worked on that table."
It's the story of a man who's now in his 70s who grew up in poor rural Kentucky. And he was not close with his father. His father was mostly sort of hassled by the child's presence, except when it came to woodworking. And they ended up working at the 4-H Club and building this table together and sanding it and finishing it and sanding it and finishing it and again and again and again. And it was beautiful. And they won the junior, or the son won the junior 4-H contest woodworking championship of the county. And he says, "I never felt closer to my father than when we were working on that table." And he has that table, you know, this is 60 years later, and the table's been kind of destroyed by his sister and revarnished, but he holds on to it because it always brings him back to that short period of closeness with the man that he loved so much.
There's also a coin that an FBI agent used to sort of touch in his pocket when he needed to find a sense of calm during intense moments in his line of work.
Right. Well, this is a really interesting psychological story. So he is an FBI agent who lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, and he always felt like the world was against him and that he got the short end of the stick. And then there was one time when he was kind of in a little bit of fight with his girlfriend, and he was just, outside of a karaoke club.
She was inside singing karaoke. She was singing Patsy Cline, and I love that detail.
Yes, that's a great thank you. And he says, and I was outside sort of feeling sorry for myself and kicking stones by the curb. And he happens to, something catches his eye, and he looks in the gutter, and there's this glinty thing, shiny thing, and he picks it out. And it's a, I think it's a 1943 Walking Liberty dollar. And in a way that, as he puts it, was the counterexample of everything that had gone on in his life. Because now he felt lucky. Suddenly he felt lucky. And he kept this in his pocket when he was on these FBI raids, before there was the, as he puts it, the screaming and kicking in of doors when they would do a raid. And he would hold on to it to ground him. And to kind of get his mindset right. And he's no longer an FBI agent, but he keeps the coin still.
I love that the object didn't become magical later. It was magical from the beginning.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's talk to Susan. Susan is calling us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Gina.
What's your thing?
Well, my grandfather went to World War One with his cousin Frank back in the, obviously, early 1900s. Frank died in the Argonne Forest, but my grandfather luckily came back, and he brought a compass, which later came to me. And my grandfather died when I was a junior in high school. I always assumed that the compass was my grandfather's, and it wasn't until many years later that I realized that the writing on the back was in German. So I don't really know if it was his or if he got it from a German soldier. And he never talked about the war, but, I never asked. And I wonder about the story he could have told me if I had said, hey, what's the story with this compass that has the German writing on the back? Where did you get it? How did that happen? But I'll never know. And so I keep it because it reminds me, ask.
That's really cool. But it's also what the object, what you don't have, that is the reminder, which is don't have the story.
I don't have the story, and I never will. So it's special because it was his, and he came home safely from the war. But it also is a reminder that there's so much that I missed out on because I never asked.
Susan, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Bill.
I mean, that's so great. I love that because, in a way, it gives her some kind of direction in her life. Ask, reach out, talk to the person, find out more. And in that way, as I was sort of mentioning before, these objects can come to hold our own values and give us direction or feel like a compass to us and help us to lead the kind of lives we want to live and be the kind of person that we want to be.
This is maybe an odd thing to say, but a friend once told me that spells and prayers are the same thing. It's just a matter of who you're asking. Mm. And when I think of a magic spell, I also think of some of the ritual that, at least if cartoons are to be believed, would come along with that. And that it often does involve like a feather or, that an object can carry a can have a direction or a spell.
And there's also something, about the ritual of it. Like, if you keep this photograph or this watch or compass or whatever the object is in a place where you can see it, every time you see it, it might for an instant bring you back, the ritual of creating space for it on the wall or on the shelf and then seeing it every day. Those rituals are important. Talking about the object with your kids or your friends, sometimes it's not just enough to have the story yourself, but it's worth sharing it.
For myself, there's a diary that I kept. It was my first diary or journal or anything like that that my mom gave me when I was 7. And I had asked for it, and she told me that I could only have it if I promised to write in it every day. And so I promised, and I did. But I usually wrote about 2 sentences large in crayon. And sometimes there was a drawing. And that was going in one direction. Then going from the other quarter cover. And those were, I would say, true things about my life. But what I remember when I look at these pages is from what I said, this is weird, but I can also remember what I didn't say. So, like,
wow.
I can remember there's a page that says, I went to Nancy's house today. I drank a lot of water. And I know that this is the day that my parents told me they were going to separate, which is weird, but I know that. Because I remember that I was at Nancy's house. You know, I remember the whole thing. But what I chose to write was, I went to Nancy's house today. We drank a lot of water. And it's, and the other direction of the book has imaginary things from my, like, my fantasy life as a 7-year-old. And I also remember those moments just sitting in my room having scenarios playing out. And when you were saying about Cheryl Strayed that this shell for her is like, it's some core essence of herself. I think mm-hmm. that diary for me is kind of the same thing, like what you say and what you don't say and what you imagine and what's real.
I would so love to see your sort of companion diary that you buy and write in now that kind of fills in the blanks that you didn't fill in as a 7-year-old. I mean, that would be a really interesting companion piece.
Thank you for the project idea.
For voyeurs like me, yeah. you know, there was also, speaking of diaries, there was another former journalist, now a futurist, whose name is Amy Webb, who talked about her diary in the book. And her mother gave her this diary when she was a kid. And she says she felt like a rock star when she got it because there was a lock on it and it was hers. And it wasn't so much about the diary itself or what's in it, but for her it was kind of the mantra of their household that this brings up for her, which is ask a lot of questions. So just like the woman who called in a moment ago, you know, don't make assumptions, look around and ask a lot of questions. And as a journalist and a futurist, that's really become her lifeblood in a way.
You know, we have a call that's just come in that we don't have time to take, but it's from someone who sells a lot of vintage. And I wonder, that perspective that you had originally with that locket, where you were one step removed from the thing, but you can see the meaning, in your case, literally inscribed. Did you encounter a lot of people like that on this journey?
People who were selling objects?
Yeah, or who came in contact with a high volume of meaningful things that were meaningful to someone else.
Interesting. So we talked to some of those people to sort of get context. But for us, what was really important were the people who owned these things and the connections that they had with them and the stories behind them.
Bill Shapiro, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bill is one of the authors of What We Keep. We originally spoke with him in May, and it's a favorite conversation from the year. We're revisiting it as we look back and say a fond farewell to 2019. Up next, another favorite on KCUR's Central Standard, the story of a taco, the Kansas City taco. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. When's the last time you had an authentic Kansas City taco? And what does that even mean? A recent article by a Texas-based writer told the story behind the Kansas City taco, and it's a story that a lot of us may never have heard before. The author, Jose Ralat, joins us to tell that story now. Jose, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you, Gina.
What is the Kansas City taco? And I mean, just a description at this point, like a menu description. We'll get into the history behind it in a minute.
Sure. It's a fried taco, but with ground beef. And the interesting part is that it's topped with Parmesan cheese.
So how did you learn about the Kansas City taco? As I've pointed out, you don't live here.
No. I was in my neighborhood, came across this pop-up. It was a taco pop-up, and they were advertising Kansas City tacos. And so I just walked over there and asked lots of questions and ate lots of tacos. And the woman, Lisa Martinez, is a Kansas City native, and she had moved down with her husband, and she just wanted to make tacos and include local art. So the operation is called Tacos and Art, and it's now at the Dallas Farmers Market. Well, I kept running into her, and I kept asking questions, and I was obsessed.
What obsessed you about it?
Well, you know, fried tacos are delicious.
Agreed.
And so lots of people think that fried tacos are not Mexican, but that's not true. Everyone fries everything everywhere. So in Mexico, they're called tacos dorados, golden tacos. Sometimes they're rolled, sometimes they're folded, and they're pinned with toothpicks, fried with their filling, and then the toothpicks are removed before eating. And I just think that fried tacos are underrated.
You know, one of the people you quote in your article, published in Eater magazine, has this to say. He told you all the Yelpers and Food Network fans across the country have put their quote-unquote knowledge on things they have zero experience in culturally or emotionally. Access to Twitter or Yelp does not make you an expert on how my grandparents made our food. Can you unpack that comment?
Sure. There's this idea that only abuelas, grandmothers, make real traditional Mexican food. And not just Mexican food, right? Everyone's got some sort of grandmother story. So there's this false or misconception that there's this ancestral knowledge passed down that does not include fried tacos, because fried tacos are American. So Americans now believe in this idea that authentic Mexican food, and I really hate that word, authentic, because there's no such thing, as I'll get to in a moment, but everyone thinks that their grandmother made the only legitimate food. But your grandmother's recipe for chocolate chip cookies?
I assure you, she did not have one.
Okay. But as an example, you know, everyone's got a different recipe for cookies. And they're all legitimate. You might think that your grandmother's chocolate chip cookies are the best. So when you go to a cookie shop and you have a chocolate chip cookie and it doesn't taste like your grandmother's, then it's wrong. Recipes or authenticity exist only on paper and is a myth overall.
You know, why don't you go ahead and tell the story of the Kansas City taco? Now that we've got some of this significance that it carries pretty well established, it was created here at a particular time and a particular place because of what was available here. In other words, I mean, even if you do believe in the idea of authenticity in abstract terms, it was authentic. It was a representation of local immigrants' reality.
Yes. I would say that tacos, just like anything else, are regional. What is the taco from Oaxaca is not the taco from Kansas City, which is where you had Mexican-Americans and Mexicans working alongside Italian-Americans and Italian immigrants. And when you have population shifts and population encounters, there's an exchange of ideas, there's an exchange of food. Well, they wanted cheese on their tacos, but the only cheese they had was Parmesan. So that's what went on their taco.
And it was railroad workers, right?
Yes. But the Mexican presence in Kansas goes as far back as the Santa Fe Trail's opening in the 1820s. So it's not like there was an unfamiliarity, but there was an increased presence with the railroads that has to deal with labor shortages And so companies like the Santa Fe would go down to the border and ship up laborers.
Talk about some of the key characters and restaurants along the way who kind of, I don't know, together create this thing that is now the Kansas City Taco and also sort of a threatened thing called the Kansas City Taco, but we'll establish its story first.
Okay. So as far as I've read, I've seen, and with whom I've talked to, there are Los Corrales, which opened up in the 40s. There's Spanish Gardens, which is now a salsa manufacturer, although they call it sauce. It was originally a restaurant. There's Manny's and a few others, but I got to speak with folks from Manny's and from Spanish Gardens. One of the fascinating things for me is that Luis Silva, who established Spanish Gardens Foods, had his young daughter grinding away at blocks of Parmesan, and she would do that for hours because that's what they had. And she talked about it nostalgically. And I don't know about you, but I hated doing that kind of labor under the instruction of an adult. So I wanted to learn more. Now, why is this so important? Well, Spanish Gardens became a fixture in the community. Luis Silva was an MC, had festivals. His name was known. And I think that notoriety helped the taco move along. Something has to be popular for it to stick. And Luis Silva's popularity certainly helped.
You know, you do express some concern that the Kansas City taco is maybe going to be a casualty of the current trend toward a taco that nationwide, you know, everyone is emulating in some way this imagined ideal of what a taco is and is supposed to be from this kind of purist standpoint.
Right. So tacos are hyper-regional. They are created from the ingredients at hand, from market demands, population experience, movements. They're not transported. But I think that this idea of originality is what makes the fried Kansas City taco a true, legitimate taco in the same way as a taco de suadero or al pastor had in Mexico City. I don't want that to go away. People don't understand, or I think they don't understand. I hope this changes, that they have a taco. It's a real taco. It's their taco.
It's our taco.
Yeah. It's your taco, and it's real. Don't lose it. I think what David was getting at, David, from Manny's restaurant, is that it was established already. Grandparents made it. Great-grandparents made this taco. It's got roots there. Don't unroot it for something that is fashionable right now.
You are on the taco beat nationally. You're the food editor for Cowboys and Indians magazine. You've also written a column known as Tacoology. You have a blog, The Taco Trail. Can I just say you have carved out a really amazing niche for yourself?
Well, thank you. It's a lot of hard work. I wish it paid more. I've been doing this for 10 years, and I started doing it because I had no idea what these things were, and I just became obsessed. Now I'm at the point where it's almost anthropology. I want these traditions preserved, and they're our traditions. Not all tacos are Mexican, and I think that's an important distinction. We have our own tacos, and we should know more about them.
What is your story? I mean, you say that you didn't know what these things were. Really, like, you picked up a taco and said, but what is it?
Yeah, so I'm actually Puerto Rican. and I met a Chicana, that's a Mexican-American from Texas. We were living in Brooklyn, fell in love, got married. She started making tacos, and I had no idea what these things were. What I knew about Mexican food at that point was what pretty much every American grew up knowing, Taco Bell. And that wasn't very good anyway. But she made me breakfast tacos, which are Texan. I thought those were amazing. Then she made me eat cow tongue, and I only did it because she asked me to try it. Otherwise, I would have said, no, thank you. That was amazing. Then we moved to Dallas, where the Dallas Observer's editor at the time, that was 2009, Mark Donald was his name, called me up, asked me if I liked tacos. I said, of course, everyone likes tacos. I didn't have a job. I didn't have insurance. So I just needed to work. And he said, pitch me an online column, which is exactly what I did. And I didn't know anything. The first few months of this weekly column were, looking back now, obnoxious. I was making pronouncements about something I knew nothing about. I was talking about authenticity when I didn't know anything about what was really legitimately part of the story.
Can I jump in here for a second? Because I think that as we talk about the misguidedness of the idea of authenticity, the fact that you're acknowledging that at one point it was in some way compelling to you is significant. Can you think back to that time? What was it that appealed to you about the idea of authenticity?
I started reading a lot. Friends would give me encyclopedias, reference books in Spanish, and all these books talked about what was indigenous to what area. I started to see this bigger picture of, well, authenticity, as we know it, is a lot bigger than I thought. Just because something is out of my experience doesn't mean that it's any less legitimate. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. I think as someone who has at this point traveled from city to city to understand tacos, which is a pretty incredible thing, what is your sense of, so Kansas City has a taco with a story to tell. Is that true of most cities in the United States, even maybe beyond the United States?
I'd say yes and no. I mean, it's, you think about Jacksonville, Florida.
Not often, but go ahead.
Right. Okay. So I wouldn't say that they have a taco. They have a sandwich. But look at New York, which has been in the news a lot for its tacos, part of the same editorial package. The United States Mexican Food on Eater included an essay on Puebla, York, that refers to the large immigrant population from Puebla, Mexico, and how they have influenced Mexican food there. Their main taco there is called the Placero. It's a big taco filled with rice and whatever else you want in it, really. That's quickly becoming its own taco, or it's quickly becoming New York's taco.
I have this other question about, I wonder if our fascination with the foods that preserved just perfectly from a particular time and place that isn't here and now is maybe preventing us from creating the foods of here and now.
Sure. Let me go to Los Angeles, where you had Koreans and Mexicans living side by side. So they exchanged ingredients. Then a chef by the name of Roy Choi took those ingredients and helped create a taco of the here and now.
The Korean taco.
Yep.
If you were to come back to Kansas City for one day and go and get something to eat, a specific thing that you ate here, where would you go and what would it be?
It would be Manny's. And it would be the taco there. And then I'd go to the Overland Farmer's Market and grab a bunch of Jolly's tortillas and take them home so that I could cook with them.
Would you make a Kansas City taco with them?
Sure, why not?
Why not? Well, Jose, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Jose Ralat wrote an article about the Kansas City taco for Eater magazine back in April. He's got a book coming out next year called American Tacos, and it covers 20 different regional tacos, so be sure and check that out. Also, since we had this conversation, Jose has gotten a new job. He is now the taco editor for the Texas Monthly. Yes, that is his actual job title, and the story of the magazine creating that position has been written up in the New York Times. So if you're intrigued and want to know more, that's where to go. And that's a wrap for today. Both of the conversations we just played are favorites from 2019. You can find them at kcur.org/centralstandard, where we archive all our shows. This morning's conversations were produced by KCUR's Melody Rowell and Chris Young, with editing by Mackenzie Martin. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.